This is an ABC podcast.
Kia ora na e aha te huru. How are you doing? This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Firstly, we'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Coming up on the show today, Tongan diaspora in the US concerned over Trump's travel bans.
There's a lot of fear among them. There's no clear-cut reasoning behind who's going to get picked up, who's not going to get picked up. And so that leads to the anxiety, not knowing if ICE is going to come knocking at their door, at their workplace.
And shortly, we'll cross to Fiji to get the latest on a leaked report about the appointment of Fiji's anti-corruption commissioner.
I'd urge the people of Fiji to just think about the manner in which this report has been handled. There are some other people that have ulterior motives here. They're not honourable.
Also, Cook Islands take on the best at World's Beach Handball Competition. Stay tuned for that and more. O vau te egi, I say maruru. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Now, firstly, the former head of Fiji's corruption watchdog says she'll fight to clear her name after a report into her appointment was leaked on social media and to local and international media organisations. The report by a commission of inquiry is scathing of the process surrounding Barbara Mulimuli's appointment as head of the Independent Commission Against Corruption last year and the senior officials involved. It describes it as legally invalid, ethically reprehensible, a damning failure of integrity, and politically manipulated to install a compromised individual into a position of immense power. Ms. Mulimuli and the others adversely named, including the Chief Justice, the Chief Register and former Attorney General, have not been given a copy of the report. The leak has complicated an already messy situation for the government, as Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka had held off releasing the report while police and FICAC conducted their own investigations. Ms. Mulimuli, who was dismissed from the position following the inquiry, says natural justice requires anyone named in the report to be given a copy to challenge it. So joining us with more details is our Fiji reporter, Lide Movono. That is a Yandere Lide. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Yandere Vinaka and Malolele to you, Aggie.
Yeah, look, firstly, as well as a damning appointment process, we see that the COI report says Ms. Mulimuli and a host of other senior officials could have potentially committed a range of offences. Are you aware of who's named and what could they have done?
Yes, Aggie, we are aware, but I must point out that these copies of the report is leaked, and so there's always a caution as to what's in it. However, in the report that we received directly from someone who was sitting in the COI, it says several senior figures, including the former FICAT commissioner herself, Barbara Mulimuli, being named for a range of offences, and along with her is the current Chief Justice Sales Itema, Chief Registrar Thomas Simbainivalu, Attorney General Graham Leung, Solicitor General Rapati Green, Deputy Prime Minister Mano Kamkamitha, and the Justice Minister Siro Mituranga. Also, even Deputy State Prosecutor John Rambuku. So it's quite a long list of people. These are people that the COI recommends should be charged. And then there's a further list of people that it's accusing of several things. But the potential offences range from abuse of office, perjury, forgery, including also obstruction of justice and conspiracy. Mulimuli herself is accused of issuing unlawful directives, lying in a statutory declaration, forging documents, as well as misusing electoral information. They're quite serious, and these are all allegations. We must state that. And she's being the report accuses these individuals of basically working together to interfere in the FICAC, our anti-corruption body's investigation of several high-profile political figures, Aggie.
Yeah, Lee, there look quite a few names that have been named there. And of course, one of them is Ms. Mulimuli. But has she herself had to say anything about the situation?
Yes, she has. She's broken her silence at last over the past several months since this began in September of 2024. Barbara has been quiet about it. She's chosen to speak only through her lawyers. But yesterday, once the COI report that this leaked version of it had made the rounds and once it was reported on in the mainstream Fijian media, she posted a really long and rather humorous statement on her social media, and in which she says that she's not been given a copy of the report, arguing that that is a breach of natural justice. And she's criticized the decision for the report to be naming people and the decision to act in the report before it's actually been shared with those who are named in it and implicated. We now, of course, have the Fiji Police Force already acting on the contents of the report. So she's saying that that's not how democracy or the rule of law works. And she's warned Fiji, and she's putting out a clear message to Fijians saying, be wary, Fiji, that we are veering into a police state territory. And she's vowed to challenge the findings of the COI in court, saying, I will fight to clear my name.
Well, besides Ms. Mari Mali, has anyone else named in the report also made comments?
We tried getting, you know, the other people who are directly implicated to speak to the allegations against them, but have not had much success. Everyone basically choosing to wait for the Prime Minister or the President to officially release the report. However, last night at the Pacific Women in Media Conference, reporters from around the Pacific did doorstop Honorable Deputy Prime Minister Manoah Kamikamitha, who's basically said that he too wants to wait for the official release of the report, but he did express his concerns over the leaks when he spoke to us last night, that you can hear right now, Aggie.
I'd urge the people of Fiji to just think about the manner in which this report has been handled. There are some other people that have ulterior motives here. They're not honourable. They're trying to, release the report before it becomes public. It is very disrespectful to the Honorable Prime Minister and the President, who will release it when they feel they want to release it. And so, it's for the police to investigate who leaked it. But and as far as I'm concerned, and I'm not making any substantive comments until that report is made public and the whole of Fiji can actually see what's in that report, so that we can see the full facts. At the moment, we're only being shown what those who have the report want us to see.
And that there is Deputy Prime Minister Manoah Kamikamitha speaking to reporters in Fiji. Well, Lee, what about Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka? You know, we realise he had held back the report despite advising the President to sack Ms. Mari Mali and even former Attorney General Graham Leong. What's he had to say?
He's been very quiet since bloggers and since witnesses in the COI have been leaking the report in a piecemeal fashion all over, you know, the digital space and the social media platforms. However, you know, he, of course, directed the police and directed the termination of the two, Mali Mali and Leong. But since the report itself has made it out into the public space over the last 48 hours, he's remained quite silent. In fact, right now he's on a personal trip to Melbourne, if I understood that correctly. Mm. But it's understood that he is releasing the official report soon. He told me 2 weeks ago to be patient, that the rest of Fiji will receive it at the same time. But so far he has not said anything at all about the implications and about the people named in the report, including even his own Deputy Prime Minister.
Again, now that part of that, report has been leaked, I mean, where do we go from here?
Well, at this point, the ball is in the court of Fiji's law enforcement agencies. Over the last 3 days or so this week, you know, there was some kerfuffle back and forth between the police, the president's office and the prime minister's office, because the prime minister had issued instructions to the Fiji Police Force's Criminal Investigations Department to look into the report and to begin their investigations. But over the last 2 days, Fijian Police Commissioner Rusiate Tundravu held a press statement to tell Fiji that the Prime Minister didn't have the authority to do that and that only the President did. So that's since happened. And yesterday afternoon, sources within the CID told the ABC that this is now their top priority investigation. FICAC too has confirmed that it's reviewing the report's findings and the allegations involving its former head. So in short, while the two authorities have the responsibility to investigate further, the political and legal fallout is far from over. The integrity of the inquiry itself is being called into question, and people have expressed their, I would say, concerns over the impartiality of the process and over also comments made by Justice David Ashton Lewis, the judge who led the Commission of Inquiry. He made some remarks on a radio station in Australia where he called on the Prime Minister to, the words he used was, expose crocodiles in the pond. Mm. And so there's a lot of concern over that, and some of which includes by political scientists at the Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand, Dr. John Frankel, whom we spoke to last night, Aggie.
When I read the chapter 7, is it, or the one about the possible offences, right, it's absolutely full of this weird kind of language, like plausibly they were doing this, arguably they were doing that, just sort of like a scattergun approach of throwing out all sorts of accusations left, right and centre. The police have now announced that they're going to take up some of this stuff. Good. I think that the very few of these charges that the His Lordship, so styled, puts around will actually be referred by the police to the Director of Public Prosecutions, and I suspect many of them, if they ever do see the light of day, will be thrown out.
And that's Dr. John Frankel, Professor of Comparative Politics at Victoria University there. Before that, we were just speaking to our Fiji reporter, Lide Movono.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia.
Vinaka and welcome back to Pacific Beat. The Prime Ministers of Tonga and Vanuatu say they are seeking clarity from the US government over possible new travel bans. Diplomatic reps from 36 countries have been warned by the US State Department of possible new travel restrictions. As Finel Funua reports, the latest move by the Trump administration has sparked confusion and fear in the region.
In Washington, D.C., a State Department official outlines the reasons behind a proposal to impose travel restrictions on nationals from 36 countries.
To protect the national security and national interests of the United States and its people, the Department of State and other U.S. government agencies assess other countries' security capabilities, information sharing, and identity management practices, exploitation of the U.S. visa system, such as overstay rates, and failure to facilitate the repatriation of their removable nationals.
State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce says the decision is not yet set in stone.
The fact is that they will have a considerable amount of time to rectify whatever the situation is that the State Department has determined is affecting the nature of our trust in how we issue a visa.
Tonga is among the 36 countries on the list, and it sparked panic among Tongans, many of them frequent travelers to the U.S. Prime Minister Isaka Eke told Parliament that his foreign minister and crown prince was currently in communication with diplomats in the US.
There have been talks with the crown prince and his ministry. He's currently speaking to Tonga's US consul and they will report back to us.
Vanuatu is also on the list. Its Internal Affairs Minister Andrew Napawat says his government is seeking more information from the US embassy.
There are several reasons, but we don't really know which of the reasons are specific to Vanuatu. So until we see the memo, we do not yet know what are the specific reasons.
For the Tongan diaspora in the US, there's concern not only about the travel ban, but about Trump's policies as a whole. Trump's proposal of removing birthright citizenship is worrying many in the community.
There doesn't seem to be any reasoning, at least a justifiable reasoning, why these three countries would be on the travel ban.
Utah-based immigration lawyer Laura Louie doesn't see how Tonga, with a population of 100,000, could pose a threat to the U.S. Miss Louie is baffled to see her country of heritage on a list of 36 nations the Trump administration is considering adding to its sweeping travel ban.
There's anxiety not only in the Pacific Island community, but there's just anxiety in general among the immigrant community. There's a lot of fear among them. There's no clear-cut reasoning behind who's going to get picked up, who's not going to get picked up. And so that leads to the anxiety, not knowing if ICE is going to come knocking at their door, at their workplace.
With speculations that Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is set to meet President Trump, Miss Louie says close partners of the U.S. need to support their neighbors.
I think it's crucial, especially country like Australia, where you have much more bargaining power than the smaller countries.
And that was Utah-based immigration lawyer Laura Louie ending their report from Whenau Whanua. All right, the sport of handball is hugely popular across Europe and around 30 million people play the game worldwide. The sport is also hugely popular in the Cook Islands, especially in the format of beach handball. This week, the Cook Islands are one of 16 nations competing at the 2025 IHF, or International Handball Federation, Youth Men's Under 17 Beach Handball World Championships, held in the North African country of Tunisia, which is some 18,000 kilometres away from Rarotonga. The Cook Islands is the second Pacific nation to play in the tournament, following American Samoa's women's team finishing 12th in 2017. So joining us now from Tunisia is Cook Islands team captain Peter Toru and head of delegation Pe'erui Tepuretu. Kia ora korua to both of you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us online.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I'd love to get straight to talking about the tournament. You know, yesterday your team went down to Thailand in a tight match, and today you play host Tunisia. I mean, talk to us about the competition so far. If I could come to you, Peter.
This competition is a really big eye-opener for all of us. This is our first time. We're all just here learning, having fun, just experiencing how it's like in a different country, far from home.
Mm. Yeah. Well, yeah, what about you, Pe'erui?
I echo the same as our captain here. Having to be able to step on an international stage, world champs, it's totally a different feeling compared to what we're used to back at home, which is like club games. We do have some exposure to some of the Oceania tournaments and that, but coming this far and being able to, step out on the stand, represent our other Oceania brothers, it has been an awesome experience. We're just loving the buzz, the vibe here, and just having that exposure.
Mm. Well, Pe'erui, I still want to stay with you. Like just getting to the tournament, right, is a huge feat in itself. Could you tell us about the logistics and, I suppose, even the fundraising to get to the tournament?
Our Cook Island Federation, our Handball Federation in the Cook Islands, is we are very fortunate to find a way to get here. Unlike some other countries that are participating at the World Champs, they have locked in funding already, granted to them through means of like their governments. They have huge sponsorships available for them. Whereas us, small nation, Cook Islands, we had to fundraise we had to go out of our way to fundraise this whole trip to get here. We started off with some fundraising efforts through a first off, we started off with a bowling Ambrose that was done locally back in Rarotonga. We went through those efforts, held that Ambrose, and we were supported by a lot of our communities that came in, families and friends that wanted to support our children and our dream of getting here. They put in teams, and we were able to sell food on the evening. We came out with some good return of funds to start off our fundraising events, and then we locked into a sponsorship, exercise sponsorship, like Gear It Up. We were asking our families and friends to sponsor numbers, and that was equal to dollar values, and attached to those values were exercises. So there was we're trying to hold the children accountable for their requests to families and friends to sponsor them, and we were able to do some exercises. I think those were our two main events. Oh, sorry, and we had one last one just before we boarded our plane. On the weekend before we boarded the plane, we did a fun run from that went from Parengaru, from Ngatangi'ia. So that is on the southeast side of Raro, and that ran along the main road and ended in town at our Avachu headquarters. So the efforts were also put towards our fundraising, our need to get here, our fundraising needs.
That sounds great. And look, you are obviously both sitting there in Tunisia because of those efforts. But Peter, I want to come to you. You know, a lot of these other countries may not even know where the Cook Islands is, right? Off the sand. What's it like meeting athletes from around the world?
It's really good. It's a good experience for us to see new people from different countries. It's good hearing different languages, also learning and making new friends from different countries as well. It's just a good experience.
Beautiful.
It's been great.
Really good.
It's been great, you know, forming, network relationships with coaches and even administration management and that. And just seeing the boys beam up when they are able to go and meet other countries and know of their cultures. You know, we would never be able to know of other countries' cultures if we weren't here. Yeah.
So it's been good. Yeah, Perui, why do you think then has handball become so popular in the Cook Islands?
Handball in the Cook Islands is, I would say, perhaps maybe the only federation that accommodates for a nice, good range of age groups. So we started off with open men's and women's age group for competitions, and then we branched out to knowing that we needed the youth. There was a lot of interest from the youth, so we expanded in introducing the youth age group. And then we also found that there was interest in having a master's age group. Wow. So our sports back at home accommodates so that all age groups can be able to participate in this sport. But I think another element that's added to it is also that the Handball Cook Islands is open to having, you know, a lot of other religions be able to participate. So usually it's very common for sports back at home to be played over the weekends. So which means it kind of isolates a certain religious group out, which like, you know, the Seventh-day Adventists. So they are unable to participate in the sport. But over the years, Handball Cook Islands has moved away from that, did a slight shift, and have prepared their competitions to be played during the week, which then opens it up for the likes of SDAs to come and participate in the sport. Those that have commitments of other sports being played on the weekends, they are able to come and play in play handball during the week. So I think that's why handball has been quite popular back home for us.
Great to hear. Look, we're going to have to wrap up pretty soon, guys. But Peter, I do want to come to you because I believe you and your brother are one of two sets of twins in the team, which is great. But, you know, most boys across the Pacific usually playing rugby, league or volleyball. But what is it about handball that you love?
Oh, that is a hard question because me and my brother, we grew up with handball. So... but if I was to be honest, it would be just the way the sport is played and the way it helps me in a way to express myself and to travel the world. It's like what I just said before, experience new stuff, new countries, and just love the sport.
Yeah.
Always have.
Awesome. And just as we wrap up, Peter, really, you know, you're going to be playing soon. Who is up next? Who are you going to be competing against for the rest of the competition?
We're not too sure about that yet. We are doing a switchover with the pools. Not too sure who we will be versing just yet.
We just completed our last game, so they're just doing up the draw for tomorrow. So it would be, my guess would be that we are to play against Iran tomorrow. So that would be interesting to see. Unfortunately, though, Iran wasn't able to make the trip as there is some warfare that's going around at the moment. So we will hopefully see what the procedures are for us to proceed to the next games, which will be held the following day.
Beautiful. Look, I just want to say me taki mata to both of you, Peter and Peruwi, for joining us this morning. We want to wish you all the best with the rest of the competition. But again, me taki mata. And that is Cook Islands Youth Men's Under 17 Beach Handball Team Captain Peter Toru and Head of Delegation Peruwi Te Puretu here on Pacific Beat. Kia ora and welcome back to Pacific Beats. We head into the region to get the latest headlines. And, of course, that is brought to you by our producer, Carl Evans, who's sitting with me in the studio right now. How you doing, sir?
Oh, look, I've felt better after certain Origin nights, being a New South Wales supporter.
Don't remind me.
At least we've got a Game 3 coming up.
Besides that, I do want to get into some of these stories here. Again, the first one here, the family of renowned Samoan fashion designer Afa'alu have spoken out for the first time since his tragic death at the No Kings protest in Utah. What have they had to say?
Yeah, that's right. So the New Zealand Herald spoke to family members of Afa'alu, who was accidentally shot after two people shot at a man allegedly armed with a rifle in Utah. He was tragically caught in the crossfire. And understandably, the family are devastated. Not only was he a renowned fashion designer, he was also a brother, a son, a husband, a father, as we've touched on in the last few days. And first and foremost, they just want to see justice done. According to the report, it was actually his mother who heard the news first. She contacted Arthur's brother. His name is Herman, who lives in Auckland. And he described, in great detail that just the pain that they're feeling, as well as a little bit about just who he was. Obviously, he was the first Samoan designer to be profiled on Project Runway, very high-profile show. Met his wife at the Church of the Latter-day Saints. By all accounts, lived a beautiful life, two children. Not surprisingly, his wife is yet to speak out because I'm sure she's devastated.
Yeah, but Carl, are there any updates, though, to the investigation that we know of?
Yeah, not that I could see. That's still ongoing, it looks like. back. However, yeah, I'd very much expect more details around that to trickle out in the coming days.
Absolutely. Okay, well, yesterday we spoke about youth concerns in the Cook Islands, but today it's the Solomon Islands who have expressed alarm over the future leaders of the country. What's happening here?
Yeah, the kids are not all right, it seems, Aggie, to misquote the song by The Who. So the Solomon Islands Governor-General, he said urgent attention is needed to basically fix the social issues that are being displayed by the youth population. He made the comments during his King's Birthday speech last Friday, citing instances of violence, rape, drug use, and just general lawlessness behaviour, which have all taken place just this year in May alone. Now, in Solomon Islands, youth is defined as a person between the ages of 15 and 34, and in Sols, that demographic makes up almost 70% of the population. So if those problems aren't addressed, they will become, as to quote what the general said, a ticking time bomb that will eventually explode, according to the governor.
Well, can I ask what he's proposing to do?
So what's interesting is the government already has a fair few policies in place around youth development. It's something they've always prioritised, and they've actually already got a dedicated youth development division within one of its ministries. But he says more needs to be done independent of government. So he wants to see churches, NGOs, civil society organisations, even development partners like Australia and New Zealand actually, you know, come in and do more. As I touched on before, Sols has the highest population growth rate of about 2.5% in the Pacific region, and so they're only getting younger.
Yeah, wow. Okay, finally, look, this is definitely tragic news for myself. Last night, if you're a New South Wales fan, let's take a listen.
This has been a spectacle to behold in Perth. Written off, dismissed, and disrespected, Queensland have risen from the dead.
Yeah, spectacle indeed. They almost lost the unlosable game, didn't they, after being 20 points up? No, look, bit of sour grapes on my part there. Obviously, heartbreak for New South Wales. And I dare say a lot of relief for Queensland and Queensland fans who managed to withstand that second half onslaught to win that game by 2 points in Perth last night. Biblical weather in the first half as well. Made for a lot of mistakes, but the intensity was high. Quite chippy as well. So a bit of a one-sided penalty count probably helped Queensland a little bit in that first half as well. But that being said, look, they played some fantastic football in the first half. Pacific fingerprints, as usual, all over the game. Hamasau to Buai Fadau, 2 tries for Queensland. Obviously, Jerome Luai coming back in for New South Wales did some nice things. Stephen Crichton was amazing. And Brian To'o, a hat-trick of tries as well. So, I mean, looking at the game, Aggie, I'm still kind of shocked that New South Wales lost, just given how much momentum they had in the second half. But look, Queensland, as they do, they're always best when their back's against the walls, and they proved that again last night.
Look, I am just going to say, Lomax, I don't know about his kicking. I feel like if he'd gotten those goals, maybe we could have won.
Just go back to Nathan Cleary, okay? Just put your trust in the quadruple premiership winning player. Just please. I don't know. Yeah, look, you're right. Because New South Wales scored more tries than Queensland. Well, so, I mean, you probably shouldn't lose when that's the case.
But, hey, it'll make for a good final. So let's see how that goes. Look, Kyle, as always, Fafatai Lover for the news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Beat.
And there's a call for labour hire companies to be licensed in New South Wales to prevent the exploitation of migrant workers. It comes as a state parliamentary inquiry into the modern slavery risks faced by temporary migrant workers sits in the horticultural heartland of Griffith today. Emily Duck has more.
The naval orange harvest is underway on Vito Mancini's farm near Griffith in the New South Wales Riverina region.
Around the world, we are the most expensive citrus, and we need to make sure that we keep in that spot by giving the customers exactly what they're paying for. Picked at the perfect time and sent to the market in perfect condition.
Migrant workers are key to getting the fruit off in time, and while Vito's confident that his pickers have good pay and conditions, elsewhere that's not always the case. A New South Wales parliamentary inquiry looking at the experience of migrant workers in regional agriculture, horticulture and meat processing has heard evidence of wage theft, overcrowded housing and allegations of labour trafficking. President of the Griffith Multicultural Council, Carmel LaRocca, has seen these conditions firsthand.
Living in abhorrent conditions because they can't find proper accommodation, where they're infested with cockroaches, bed bugs, not enough power. So this sort of thing is ordinary in Griffith, like it's everywhere.
One of the reasons Griffith was chosen to host the first regional inquiry hearing was because it was highlighted by the New South Wales Anti-Slavery Commissioner in a report last year. That report said there were early warning signs that organised labour trafficking may be emerging in Griffith on a small scale.
Then there's the exploitation where, say, people with no work rights, they can't find a legitimate job. People use them to pick fruit and things like that, but then paying them is another story. A lot of them don't get paid, and so they have no money.
Carmel LaRocca will be telling those stories at today's hearing and calling for more funding for community groups like hers to support migrant workers. A common thread in the inquiry so far has been the operation of labour hire providers. These businesses supply workers to farms and handle the recruitment and payroll. Other states have licensing systems, but New South Wales doesn't, and the inquiry chairman, MP Joe McGirr, says that's a problem.
That's meant that the shonky operators have left Queensland and Victoria and are operating in New South Wales. And that evidence was repeated by a number of witnesses at our last hearing. So concerning, in fact, that the committee requested that I meet with the Attorney General to raise that issue directly.
The New South Wales government says it's engaged with the Commonwealth and other jurisdictions with a view to establishing a national labour hire licensing scheme. The Albanese government committed to implementing that scheme in 2023, and $4 million has been provided to Victoria for initial scoping for a national regulator. Grower Vito Mancini also wants to see the regulation and better policing to get rid of dodgy operators.
We need to have something out there that at least keeps the workers assured that they know who to contact, or even the authorities who to contact if something goes astray. Because at the moment, we've heard too many times where a worker doesn't get paid, they call the number, it gets disconnected, and then suddenly the farmer gets contacted by the worker saying, hang on, I haven't been paid for the work I've done in your farm. Hands get thrown up in the air and these poor guys go home without any food on their table.
And that's grower Vito Mancini ending that report from Emily Doak.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Politalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Politalk.
Tuesday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Vinaka Vakalevu, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Look, to the Solomon Islands, where there is more than 70 indigenous languages, including Solomon Islands Pidgin, are spoken. But however, many of these languages are in decline among younger generations, not only because of an education system oriented towards its official language, English. There is a proposal now for a Solomon Islands Indigenous Language Centre that's being touted as a way to retain traditional languages for future generations. So to get a better understanding on this topic, I have here in studio with me Lenora Homer, Head of the Department of Languages and Communications, and also Deborah McDougall, Co-Director of the Oceania Institute at the University of Melbourne. We just want to say good fella morning and welcome to Pacific Beat, ladies.
Good fella morning.
Good fella morning, Aggie.
Yeah, thank you so much. Look, I know it's been a bit of a hectic morning, but thank you again for being with us here live in studio. I sort of want to come to you first, Lenora. You know, I understand English is the actual official language, right, in Solomon Islands, but we also know that international research shows that a solid foundation in a child's first language is essential for literacy, not only on a national stage, but globally. I mean, your thoughts on that?
Thank you, Aggie. It's so lovely to be here. I feel so privileged to be here, actually. So English is the official language in the Solomons at the moment. And then we have this other 60-plus indigenous languages that don't find their way in the classroom and in education. And so, as you have rightly said, research has shown so many times that first language is the best language for a student or for learning. And so we can say that that's an issue already. Mm-hmm. Students are struggling, not necessarily to learn things that they don't connect to easily because they are either foreign or they are in a language that they don't understand, and so that's an issue for learners.
Well, as I mentioned in the intro, you know, I said that there's reports have said that there's a decline, right, in speaking one's mother tongue. Can you ask why? Why do you think that's happened so much for the Solomon Islands?
So, beside English as the official language, we also have the lingua franca, which is Solomon Pidgin, and one of the social concerns or issues that Solomon Islands is facing at the moment is urban migration. And so many people are moving to urban centers, particularly Honiara, to find a better way of living or find economic activities. And so there is a gradual and observing what is happening at the moment, there's going to be a shift. Right now, many people speak the lingua franca, which is Solomon Pidgin.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you for clarifying that. Deborah, I know you're here alongside supporting Lenora in this initiative. I mean, again, what's your involvement with this?
I have two hats in this work. One, I've been working for 30 years in a rural area of Solomon Islands, an island called Renonga, where there's actually a very successful locally run language school that goes into quite a lot of detail in teaching and learning Lunga language and Kumbakota language with Dr. Alfia Sombule. And so I've been tracking the effects of that, and it's been remarkable. Both, so it's a win-win because they learn their own language and they really automatically transfer that over and are better able to learn English. So that's a kind of a really great case study that Leonore and I are working with. Yeah. And my other hat, I think, is at the University of Melbourne. I'm the co-director of the Oceania Institute, and one of our goals is to link up expertise in Australia with regional universities. And so there's a great deal of expertise. There are a lot of grammars and studies of the languages of Solomon Islands, but it doesn't sort of connect up. And we feel Solomon Islands National University is a wonderful growing institution that trains all of the teachers. So working with Leonore on developing the center that can be a spot where both community leaders and teachers and scholars can celebrate, document, preserve, and really promote Indigenous languages and Pidgin, which is, of course,
beautiful. And that's I'd love to come to you, Lenora, about that. How significant is it to be able to establish something like this, like a Solomon Islands Indigenous Language Centre?
Oh, it's going to be huge, Aggie. It is something that many Solomon Islanders have wished and aspired for the country to have. When you think about a small country, so linguistically diverse and with 60 plus languages, as I have said, people want a space that these languages can be not just be promoted, but celebrated and be recognized. Because when we think about, we all know our language is our identity. And people are shifting to Solomon Pidgin and English, and that they're losing their identity, and that is something that no one would want to do.
Of course. Deborah, are there any challenges that you guys are facing in terms of having to get this initiative moving forward?
Well, I think there's one big challenge around this the in introduction of vernacular languages, including Pidgin, into the curriculum. And that is the idea that school is for English and school is for work. And so education is for a job. And if you need a job, you need to speak English. So I think really communicating, no, it's not a either or, it's a both and. And the more you learn, the more you celebrate, the more you understand the structure of a familiar language, the better that you can get into that language that everyone in the country wants to speak. And I think the other challenges of building a center is always a challenge, and working out what the priorities are and how that can be something that's gonna last and is going to not be directed by outsiders like me and what we think is important, but really addressing the needs of Solomon Islanders.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, do you have has this initiative sort of been met with support from the Sols government? I mean, you know, what are we looking at cost wise for this to really come to fruition?
At the moment, I can say we are privileged to have a partnership with the University of Melbourne, but over the years, there hasn't been any institutions that's committed and dedicated to supporting work around Indigenous languages. Mm. And so this is something that once shared with the government, it's going to be supported, I believe.
Awesome. Well, this is the thing. You're here right now in Melbourne, en route to the 13th Conference on Oceanic Linguistics. What will you be speaking about?
So, I'm here to share and seek support for the establishment of the centre, particularly at the Oceanic Linguistics Conference. I know that there will be linguists there. There will be people who have worked on and around linguistics, and it will be a great space to share what we are doing and to network, because I believe that the strength and the support that we need is going to come from the networks that we or SINU establish here and onward.
Oh, that's great to know. Deborah, and I'd love to get a feedback from both of you. You know, once this is established, what are you hoping? Like, has there been any sort of response from the community knowing that this could happen?
I'll speak. Just the other week, I brought some of the teachers and translators. So one of the things we should mention is that a lot of the language work in vernacular languages in the country has been done through Bible translation. And it was such a privilege to bring my colleagues from the Kulu Language Institute to meet with Leonora at the university. And it was such a privilege for those folks, many of whom have been pushed out of school, to come and be at the National University and hear and see their knowledge and their understanding recognized. Yeah. So I think beyond improving literacy outcomes, which is a real important aim, I think that recognition from within official university academic very valued language, the recognition of local knowledge of Indigenous languages, is going to make a lot of the people, especially young people who feel marginalized, mm-hmm. feel a bit more recognized. So I think it's part of also a broader initiative from that university, Solomon Islands University, to recognize and celebrate Indigenous forms of knowledge.
Beautiful. Lenora, you know, we're going to have to wrap up soon, but I want to ask, as a Solomon Islander yourself, you know, having to preach to the choir, you know, that this is something that's really important. I mean, what does it really actually mean to you to see this initiative come to fruition again?
It's a very personal question, Aggie. When I was at primary school, the only punishment that I would receive is for speaking my own language.
Wow.
that means a lot to me now that I'm doing this work and seeing what is happening in the country. People are losing out on their language. I want to change that perception that our Indigenous languages has value. Our Indigenous languages are who we are as Solomon Islanders.
And that's the thing, as a Solomon Islander, look, I remember coming to your beautiful country last year for the Pacific Games. You know, these are going to be big moves for the country itself. You know, Deborah, can I just come to you to end off? Again, what do you hope will come out of this?
I've seen the amazing, mind-blowing multilingualism of this country be framed as a deficit, as a problem, and I would love to have it be seen as the great blessing that it is. That's my overall hope.
Look, that's all the time that we have for you ladies this morning. It is such a privilege to have you both in the studio this morning. Again, I just want to say tagye tumas. Thank you again.
Tagye tumas.
No worries.
Hey, Michael Chow, are we on?
Jacob McQuire, yes, we are.
ABC Radio Australia.
Great work to us. We just got ABC Radio Australia up and running here in Majuro. Yakwe.
If you're in Majuro in the Marshall Islands, tune your radio to 106.7 FM for the latest Pacific news, sport, music, and entertainment.
And if you're... Wait, Michael Chow, pass me that coconut. This is thirsty work, bro.
ABC Radio Australia.
Yours in the Marshall Islands.
And the Pacific.
Recapping our top story with the former head of Fiji's corruption watchdog, Barbara Malimali says she'll fight to clear her name.
Malimali herself is accused of issuing unlawful directives, lying in a statutory declaration, forging documents, as well as misusing electoral information. They're quite serious.
And that's ABC Fiji's reporter, Lithi Mavono. We'll be back same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can tune in to us 5 p.m. this afternoon. You've just been tuning in to Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference.
Search up ABC Nisha Daily Afternoon Edition to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.